Welcome, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Today, we have the pleasure of talking with Colson Whitehead, whose book, The Underground Railroad, has really just jumped off the shelves. And, of course, Oprah made it her favorite book, which doesn't hurt when you want things to jump off the shelf.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Colson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And so this is clearly not your first book. I mean, The Intuitionist and John Henry Days and all the other pieces you've written over the years. And before we jump into the heart of this book, one of the things I discovered about some of the other books of yours that I know, at least The Intuitionist and John Henry Days, and I've not read the others yet, but I'm looking forward to reading them now, is that you seem to take – every one of your books is different. Sometimes you meet an author and you interview them and their books are pretty – they follow a pattern. You don't seem to have a pattern.
Well, I mean, I think – I started off writing and I was very self-conscious and didn't want to attack things from a stereotypical way. So I didn't want to write – your first novel was autobiographical. It was the early 90s and, there's a Gen X novel of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I've always just tried to avoid what I thought was a stereotype. And so I wanted to write about race, but not in a way that other people had done it. And so
that
became The Intuitionist.
Right.
Sort of an accidental, backed in accidentally into the racial allegory in that story. I just wanted to write about a detective, a elevator inspector who becomes a detective. And it became about elevators and elevation and social uplift and social progress. And so the metaphors for race creeped in. And I just kept up with that. I mean, if I write a novel with a strong plot, maybe the next one doesn't have as strong a linear momentum. My last book was very humorous. I thought they were jokes, but it was a book about the World Series of Poker that was, crammed.
Right. I read about the book.
Crammed with jokes. And in this book, sort of devoid of jokes. And so I'm always just trying to not repeat myself so that I don't get bored. And there are people who are turned off by that. Like, I like a realistic story. I don't like zombies. I like this. But then there's some people who, appreciate that.
But there's something about this book and some of the others that I know that you have a – it's almost like to me it's really serious in terms of it's our history. It touches the human core, but it's like magic realism meets Afrofuturism in a sense, just the way you approach – like where you approach this.
Yeah, for me, Afrofuturism, fantasy, fabulism, magic realism are all on a continuum. I don't distinguish. I mean, I – wanted to write because I was reading Marvel Comics, in sixth grade, X-Men and Spider-Man, and reading Stephen King and Arthur C. Clarke and watching A Twilight Zone. And so my introduction to literature / storytelling is always has some element of fantasy. And The Intuitionist takes place in an alternative noirish city. Zone One is a book about the apocalypse, and so of course an element of sci-fi there. And then the magic realism in this book is has a low-key fantasy element. But for me, you pick the right tool for a job, and sometimes realism is the right thing, and sometimes an element of fantasy or a lot of fantasy.
But I mean, because when you look at the heart of the book, I mean, someone could have taken this subject, and many people have. But that twist you give it in terms of creating worlds that really didn't exist but represent worlds that do exist, whether North Carolina, South Carolina, the literal Underground Railroad, and more.
I was really just thinking of hearing about the Underground Railroad in fourth grade and thinking it's a literal railroad. And
of course, thought that as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, for a few minutes. Some people still believe it, as they've grown up. But, my teacher corrected me. But that image is so powerful. Just the word is so evocative. And it seemed like an interesting premise, like what if it actually was a tunnel? And then in terms of what you're talking about and going different places in American history or what might have been, I added the second element of sort of Gulliver's Travels, where each state our protagonist goes through is a different state of America. There's a white supremacist state, a sort of black utopian state. And by not sticking to the rules of the historical novel. I'm allowed to mix and match history and really explore what has and hasn't changed and what's similar about American concepts of race in 1850 or 1920s. How does something like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment come into being? How do social programs from the 60s, Great Society programs, play out when you put them in friction with slavery? And so, you know, right. so by using that fantastic element, I'm allowed to play with time in a way I couldn't do in a realistic novel.
I mean, one of the things that that really struck me about – there were so many things in this book. But first, let me just talk about this, the person you developed. Yeah, and you've done this before where you've kind of developed women characters in a very serious way. And Cora is the core of the book.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, she's our protagonist. And, I there are many reasons I picked her or started thinking about her as someone to carry the story. I'd had a string of male protagonists who were similar in temperament. You know, I think the alternative version of me, that's the narrator of Noble Hustle, the main character in Zone One. They sort of think a lot and they're very interior, not necessarily as decisive as they could be. So I wanted to break out of that. One of the first slave narratives I read in college was the story of Harriet Jacobs, who was in North Carolina, ran away from her master and hid in an attic for 7 years until she could get passage out. And
oh, that's where that came from.
Yeah. And so her, you know, and she says early on in that, in her narrative that, when she hits 14, she enters into that worst stage of life for a slave girl, when you're now a sexual being and you're prey to the sexual appetites of your master or other slaves. And also you're supposed to pump out more slaves. You know, you're supposed to breed, pump out more babies who can work the land and make more money and, you know, become part of this huge economic engine. And so the plight of the female slave is, you know, terrific in a different dimension than the male slave. And it seemed something that was worth inquiry, for me as a writer. And then also it'd been a while since I had a female protagonist, and I never addressed a mother-daughter relationship, which is, you know, is important to her psychology in the book.
So I'm curious, when you tackle a book like this, I mean, it was about slavery, clearly, but every time as I was reading the book, I kept flashing on where we live right now.
Sure.
Connections you can just make in every kind of twist and turn of what happens and how you describe what happens to an enslaved person, the confrontation with the paddy rollers and the police. And I mean, I kept in my head, I kept popping into the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have that idea, such a direct parallel with 2016 America when I started. But it was unavoidable when you start doing the research and learn about the patrollers, the slave patrollers. You know, before there was a police force, the slave patrollers would go into plantation, the slave villages, knock on the doors of free men and free women, and demand to see their papers. If there's a runaway, you know, they had free license to bust heads and stop any black person on site and rouse them. And growing up as an African American male in New York City in the 80s, my first acquaintance with police brutality or the deaths of Eleanor Bumpers, Michael Griffith, graffiti guy who was put in a chokehold. And so I was hitting 14 like Harry Jacobs, and my dad said, you're a target when you leave the house. And you never know when any interaction with a policeman can go awry. And I think that's not news to a lot of people. But the way that the former slaves who'd escaped and were writing their narratives would talk about the slave patrollers with the exact same language. And so it just pops out at you. I didn't have to force these connections. They're just constant.
And one of the things you didn't do in this book, which was really interesting to me, I mean, clearly the motion that affects people's actions are the racism and the enslavement of African people. But no matter who you're talking about, whether you're talking about the enslaved, or whether you're talking about the abolitionists themselves, black or white, or the people who did the enslaving, or their apartheids, who apartheids.
I've never said it out loud. So
right. I read it. How do you say it?
I'll follow you.
So, but they're always kind of nuanced and layered. I mean, there's like. You weren't afraid to kind of make good and evil and people with issues they're wrestling with inside of those characters. You know, they weren't just all kind of uniform. All the people who had been enslaved or all the black folks in the book were not all wonderful and good. And it was, so it was you really kind of trying to hit the nuances of society. And all.
Well, you know, I wanted to create a psychologically rich plantation, but then also
right.
In general, you know, as an artist, you want to have everyone have dementia, even if they're loathsome. And so so in terms of the slaves, I think in pop culture, which is how most of us encounter Tales of the Plantation, 100 person plantation, there's like an Uncle Tom or something who's informing, but everyone else is helping each other. And just my view of human nature, that's not how it works. And you know, we have an idea of PTSD. Mm-hmm. On a plantation, you're not post anything. You're experiencing trauma every day of your life, and you're not going to be that perfect version of yourself. And you're not going to be helping each other. You're trying to survive. And I think if you get 100 people in a room, 10 are great, 10 are terrible, and most of us kind of vacillate back and forth. And if you put people in a plantation and they're brutalized every day of their life, and they have no hope, and they're desperate. They are going to be they're not going to be in their best behavior toward each other. So that's my plantation. And then in terms of the people who help or don't help Cora, you know, white or black, they have different motivations. A lot of slave masters had their own philosophical or biblical justifications for slavery. And over the course of the book, we get Christians who have their rationale for why it's okay to enslave blacks. We have capitalists who have their own, you know, sort of money-grubbing idea of why it's okay to enslave blacks. And then, and of course, there are white abolitionists who are helping out. But then also, there's people who just don't really care. You know, there's one person named Ethel who's married to
the reluctant abolitionist.
The reluctant abolitionist. And she's sort of caught up in Cora's escape. And, you know, she doesn't care about slavery. She's just preoccupied in her own life. In the same way that people, you know, I'm not always thinking about Syria every day or poverty. And, you know, people have their lives and not thinking about the larger questions of what's going on in the world. And so people are pro-slavery, anti-slavery, and invest in different ways. And then there are also people who just didn't think about it at all.
Well, that part – so Ethel's character, let's say, for argument's sake. So this the character who's married to a man who is as I said, a reluctant abolitionist. And he's really nervous about everything he did, but he's trying to live up to his father's stuff. And so right? But she grows up in a home that wasn't pro-slavery, pro-enslaved people, but really didn't care. I mean, to me, it was like the quintessential thing about America, which is that people like in today's world don't see it, don't get it. Don't hear it, and don't really want to hear it.
No, for me, an accurate portrayal of the human condition and how we feel about things. And so, you know, I'm not making all white people villains and all the abolitionists aren't saints. Everyone is human, and it's my job as an artist to make everyone have different dimensions.
Now, I love this book. The book is really, to me, gripping. I mean, you keep turning the page. What's going to happen next? And we're not going to talk about the end of the book, but I mean, I. I won't do that, but no spoiler alert here. But I was always kind of the whole book. I was just going, "Oh, Cora, where's she going to end up? What's going to happen to her? Where's she going to go next? Is she going to make it out of this?" I mean, it was like, you know, I was waiting for her to be killed, waiting for things to happen. I mean, so it's that the way you write keeps us rolling inside this character all the time.
Well, you know, the stakes are high. They're
really
life,
high.
They're life and death. I mean, and that's
literal
built into the story of an escaped slave. If you're caught. You're going back into hell, and you can be punished. You can be killed, as an example. But will she escape? I mean, I think immediately when you're acquainted with the horror of her home plantation, you don't want her to get back there. And, I've written books for – there's not a strong plot. You know, my book, Psycho Harbor, is about just growing up over the course of the summer, and it has – the stakes and rhythms of summer. And
it's very different.
It's very different. And then this, you know, is Cora going to live? Is she going to die? And so it is more linear and has a lot more suspense than some of my other books.
A lot of suspense. A lot of suspense. And you say Sag Harbor. You spent your summers in Teddy Roosevelt's backyard.
Because he –
That was where he had his house, right?
No.
Sagamore Hill. I have it backwards.
Yeah, no. But
my mistake.
but there are plenty of big estates.
Plenty of big estates. Yeah. So you have these some of these great lines in here that make when you talk about the dancing that took place and what people did to survive and go through it and the dancing that took place and how it was interrupted and people then use the people who enslave people use that as an excuse to start whipping people and getting people in line. But you have this great line, by making a circle of themselves that separated the human spirits within from the degradation without. It's just that – I mean, there's so many lines like that in here that just – oh.
No, I mean, you know, you couldn't survive – you can't survive on a plantation without some notion of hope, whether it's in your children or those brief moments of liberation. And that's where that's the sort of passage you're talking about there where – occasionally you do have a feast and you do have music and dancing and it's a brief celebration of life in the midst of this hell. And if you don't have that, how do you go on? And I think that's the same idea as animating Cora on her journey. If she doesn't have the idea that there is a safe place, a place of freedom somewhere, you don't leave. I mean, so whether it's a feast for someone celebrating someone's birthday that gets you through 6 months of terror, or the hope of a place of freedom that gets you through all the travails as you escape, you need that animating light.
You do, and I think that there's a piece in here where you switch into the character for a moment. That Ridgway, who is the man who the slave catcher, and this is. When he is, I love this line. Well, I think if I remember right, he's talking to his father, and he says, "We're both of us working for Mr. Eli Whitney."
Sure, the cotton gin, enables the explosion of the cotton industry, and Arnold Ridgway's father is a blacksmith, so he's making chains to keep Africans in line. He's making nails for the new houses or the new communities that are sprouting up along the cotton routes. Making wheels for the carts that bring stuff to market, and so his business is booming. And then his son, as a slave catcher, of course, is policing runaway slaves and keeping the system going so it doesn't break down. And so, whether you're a really rich slave master overleveraged in debt because you're overmortgaged your farm to expand, or you're a blacksmith just making the simple iron tools that keep the cotton industry going, or a slave master, you're also enslaved by the system, and it's a capitalist system.
And in some ways, you take on this capitalist system, this book throughout, with quotes like that.
Well, yeah.
To understand the roots of who we are, the roots of capitalism are embedded in the roots of enslavement. And there's one piece in here where you talk about, Cora might be saying, I forget who says it, or one of Cora's friends says it, where they, that the land was stolen from the native people and genocide took place, and then they took the land and we were put on that land as part of the property. I mean you really point these out over and over again inside.
No, yeah, I mean it's a system, and I think I start with a portrait of Cora's grandmother who is bought from a slave trader in Ouida on the west coast of Africa, along with 60 other people for rum and guns and beads. And so that first transaction isn't even for money. It's for objects. Like, I'm taking this person I've made into an object, a slave, an African, making them into a slave, and our transaction is for other material goods.
Right.
And then that's the start of her experience in America. She's a piece of property, and she's traded a couple times before she ends up on her last plantation. But she's reduced to something with monetary value, and that's on the first page, and that's how we meet her.
No, that kind of story, that kind of line that runs through the book to me is like, I mean, it's really important, I think, and it's also important the way you do it, and you do it in such a, in these subtle ways, just the way you lines. I mean, It makes me want to ask you the question that's probably not directly related to the book, but really hit me thinking of this. I mean, just every writer is different in terms of how they approach their work and where they, you know, where they learn their craft and how they learn their craft. So I'm just curious about yours. I mean, and where it began for you, this kind of this journey to writing and being able to get deep inside your head to create these worlds that don't exist but do exist.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, again, it was fantasy literature. It was comic books and Stephen King.
When did you write your first story?
In college, I wrote two stories. I wrote, you know, terrible. So to audition for the creative writing classes, and each time I was turned down. They're terrible stories. But being a journalist at the Village Voice, that was my first job out of college.
Right.
And there, you know, I think that the kind of pop cultural stuff they're doing then is now really common. But, you know, you're writing about a show, a TV show or a book or a movie, but you're bringing in a real political context and from the left. And so you are supposed to, you know, talk about the political and social forces that are shaping a piece of art and do it in an engaging style, a colloquial style. And I grew up reading The Village Voice and worshiping it in high school and wanting to be one of these kind of cultural critics who writes about film one day, music the next.
Right.
And now it's really common, but, you know, it was really fortifying back then. And then, you know, if you're writing science fiction or fantasy, you're really engaged in world building. I think even if you're writing realistic fiction, you're building a world, but where are the rules when you have vampires or it's 20 years in the future and robots are slaves? When I started writing so-called literary fiction with some fantastic element, I was drawing upon the more straightforward fantasy fiction I grew up reading. How do you make an elevator inspector important? So you have to make a world where elevator inspectors are important, and you're building up the rules of the world the same way as if you're writing about a Martian colony in 2222.
Or if you're writing about this fantastic railroad that goes under people's homes.
Sure, yeah.
Secret shoots to get to the Underground Railroad. So where did that come to you from? How did that come to you? The idea that – I mean, I too, growing up, grew up with this idea that when I first heard about it, the Underground Railroad was actually a railroad.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But then you realize it wasn't, and you learn it wasn't. But so where did that idea come from, the idea of excavating beneath the ground? And
well, I mean, you know, just that image and making it real. Then how do you get a story out of it? So for me, the tone is not important. It's what's important about it is its use as a doorway. I mean, her last trip on the railroad is longer, and there's more stuff going on there. But for me, I really want to get her from the realistic plantation in the Georgia section to this new world in South Carolina that has its own rules. And so whereas in John Henry days, when I'm talking about the importance of the railroad in 1870, it's connecting the country and allowing commerce and human traffic and the trade of goods, and comparing that to the information age in 1996 when the book takes place, and how the information superhighway is another way of linking people together and ideas and places. So the metaphor is right. You know, is clear there. For me, the railroad is really just about how can I get Cora through these different American experiences. So it's a threshold and not a tunnel, I think.
Yes, exactly. It's a threshold, not a tunnel. No, exactly right. Exactly what it is. Colson Whitehead, The Underground Railroad is an incredible book. You do want to read this book. And good to have you here, man.
Thanks a lot.
Welcome, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Today we have the pleasure of talking with Colson Whitehead, whose book, The Underground Railroad, has really just jumped off the shelves. And Colson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, I was thinking about what you did in North Carolina and South Carolina. It was First, I got to tell you this funny story. So I'm reading the book, and you talk about what happened in South Carolina and how North Carolina had passed these laws to like, you know, lynch every black person and get them out of the way. And I started thinking, wait a minute, did that happen? So I
sure, yeah.
Did that really happen? But I love that, the juxtaposition of really, really, again, relating to where we are today, of the eugenics, the seemingly ideal place, quote unquote, built on eugenics, and the next place where it was just built on slaughter and genocide, of fear of black folks.
Well, once I was freed, having a little railroad takes me away from the historical record and allows me to have that sort of play. So maybe, say North Carolina, they come up with the final solution.
The Negro problem,
which is to abolish all Negroes. And if you're caught, you'll be lynched, and lynched in a very public ritual. And so I'm borrowing – and so it's a white separatist state. So I'm borrowing from, say, the origin of Oregon, which was founded as a white separatist state. There were race laws in North Carolina that curtailed black movement. And, of course, if you're – they're definitely in the 20th century, small towns in the South where you don't let the sun set on you.
Sunset towns are very real. They're all over this state. All over this state.
Yeah.
Right.
And then so bringing those two things. Then also Nazi Germany. I talked about Harriet Jacobs and how she hid in an attic. You think attic, Anne Frank. And then, so how do you make how do you describe the continuum of oppression and demonizing the other, whether it's black people in the South in the 1900s, 1800s, or Jews in Germany? And, the same white supremacist ideals that governed how blacks were treated in the South were how Jews were treated in Nazi Germany. And so I can enlarge the conversation and find and open up different ways of talking about oppression, because it's all really the same oppression,
right.
It's all this hatred of the other, and so that choice I made really many years ago just paid off in so many different ways of how I could play with history and have the real and the fake that seems real all sort of communicate with each other.
That's kind of the beauty of what you were just saying, I was thinking about and also thinking about this book itself when I was reading it, that it's a really wonderful thing when you can have this imagination that most people have, I think, that can take us off in these worlds and create things that don't exist. But the ability to allow yourself and for us to help, just me to help allow our children to be able to take that and use it this way, right? Whether it's a printed page or whether it's a computer game or whether it's a painting or whatever that is.
No, sure.
Right? I mean, that's you're going to take your mind and kind of focus it into this and create these worlds for everybody else.
Well, I think for me, this book is more focused than some of my other works, and I've had books that are full of digressions, like I'm riffing on pop culture, and I think here I was just really trying to be direct in a way that I'm not always direct, and I think it allows people to come along and by not over-explaining or having fun with the narrator's voice, I'm allowing the reader to sort of interpret it without that filter. So maybe it's hard to describe, but
No. And so you develop this character Cora, who over the period, her deep intellect comes through in what she learns, what she sees, and learning the written word, but her observations of the world. You can see. I mean, you work to this creating this woman who really has this incredible growth of understanding and feeling that to me was just the way you developed her slowly like that.
No, thanks. I mean, she starts as an object. She's a slave.
Right.
She's not a person. And so when she, every, foot by foot, mile by mile, as she goes north to freedom, she's becoming more of a person and aware of who she is and interpreting the world. And so, I'm picking situations that, where she can get educated about the world and have her own reactions and learn bit by bit. She learns to read, in slave narratives. That's a really important moment in most of them when the slave finally learns their letters and takes mastery over their own story. So, you know, so Cora, and that's part of escape from slavery is finding your own voice and learning about the world. And so, she has an idea of freedom. It's in the North, and she has a better job, and she's not enslaved. But it's also intellectual freedom and knowing about the world in a way you've never even had an idea you could.
Right. Her analysis of the world is really important, I think. Her observations there. It made me think that, you know, that as reading the book, that when you watch her go through what she goes through and watch this progression in places, that we really have to take a moment and step back from the book and kind of reflect on this moment we're in. I mean, okay, I've said that before, but there's something about this book that just because people get tired. Some people go, "I'm tired of slave narratives."
It's because I don't read a lot, so it never occurred to me to be sick of them.
No, me either. No.
I wonder who these people are who are reading so many narratives.
But what you're doing is adding to a moment that's really important now, because we're beginning to understand, I think, more now than we did before, the resistance to slavery that took place and the desire for people to create a world like the world you created in Indiana, to create community and build. I mean, this is we're beginning to understand there was a much deeper history than has been led on to or that we were allowed to know. You know, and the kind of book is part of that, I think, cycle of the moment where we're really understanding that that the Maroons existed, that they lived in a dismal swamp, that they ran away. Many people ran away. And you look at the newspapers from the 19th century and you see all these ads for people who had run. So clearly hundreds of people were trying to run and being caught and brought back. And
yes, yeah.
Thousands, I mean to say. You know, so, I mean, that's really an important piece because that resistance is critical.
No, and you know, the Underground Railroad is, you know, a great – it's legendary and it's very inspiring. And then there are people who just ran and weren't helped. And – just made it out, and we're so glad they made it out. And their stories never told because it's like, I'm never speaking of that again. So people are running, people are being caught.
Lots of people being caught.
People are going to Mexico, to Canada, and not being caught up in, not that there are many histories about the Underground Railroad, but in history as we know, there's so many small acts of escape and rebellion. And even if you don't leave, how do you just protect your child? And that's one act of rebellion, or how do you protect this person who is helpless?
Or in the face of what you see as the torture of other human beings who escaped and were brought back, knowing what your fate is and still not stopping.
Yes, yeah.
What your fate could be, I should say.
And, you know, would you I have one strain of family that comes from Virginia, and we're, you know, free people of color who had taverns. And most of my family, this comes from, you know, anonymous South. And is it Florida or Louisiana? What kind of places do they live and die on? And so part of what makes, I think, the first section realistic and brutal is because I wanted it to be realistic and true to everything that my nameless family went through. Right. Anybody who's here, most people are here now, if you're African American, your family somehow survived the black hole of slavery and was burped up at the time of the Civil War.
Right, and I think that the way people are described in this book, you can understand the kind of essence of the internal power that allowed people to survive and make it through. I mean, that is all through here.
Well, just to survive, you know, a year on the plantation, you know.
I mean, I don't know.
Incredible fortitude. Yeah.
What any of us would have done if we were in. I mean, the more real. I think it's important to understand that reality, because if you don't understand that reality, as many people have quoted, that history is now. It's not the Faulkner said it. Baldwin said it. They all said it in different ways. But if you don't understand what you're writing about here in terms of that moment, you cannot understand what a young kid in West Baltimore or Bed-Stuy or some other place I can name is going through at the moment.
No, I mean, it's the past is not even past. It's a cliche, but it's true.
Right.
And, you know, institutional racism, slavery by another name, and it's sort of obvious, but it's true. I mean, the systems persist under different guises, and a lot of people are spending a lot of energy in making sure that that happens.
So the one thing that's just total digression, but you said something I think is really interesting, because most people don't say what you just said earlier when you described people ran. Most people don't realize that there were a lot of folks who were enslaved in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas that did go to Mexico.
Sure, yeah.
That was the other way people went.
Yeah.
It wasn't all to Canada.
Yeah. And it was a swamp. It was like, you know, swamps in Florida, and we make our own community.
Right.
Yeah.
The Maroons.
Can't find us. Yeah.
Right. That's real. So so Cora, you said, if you want to read it, I want to read it however you want to do it.
Sure,
whatever you're comfortable doing.
Yeah, sure.
This little piece in here, that's what I underlined in yellow, whatever you want to start, just because it says so much about her. Maybe we can talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so she's having a few interactions with the Declaration of Independence, and this is one when she's in South Carolina. She didn't understand the words, most of them at any rate, but created equal was not lost on her. The white men who wrote it didn't understand it either, if all men did not truly mean all men. Not if they snatched away what belonged to other people, whether it was something you could hold in your hand like dirt, or something you could not like freedom. The land she tilled and worked had been Indian land. She knew that white men bragged about the efficiency of the massacres, where they killed women and babies and strangled their futures in the crib. Stolen bodies, working stolen land. It was an engine that did not stop, its hungry boiler fed with blood. With the surgeries, the sterilizations, that Dr. Stevens described, Cora thought, the whites had begun stealing futures in earnest. Cut you open and rip them out, dripping. Because that's what you do when you take away someone's babies, steal their future.
What she discovered there and her refusal to take part in it.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, at various points in the last 150 years, there have been sterilization movements, you know, sterilize the mentally ill. We've locked away in sanitariums, sterilize the feeble-minded, sterilize immigrants, black people, so they don't breed and become a scourge and don't place a burden on society. And so the sort of positive social programs of South Carolina are emerging with these other social programs, such as the eugenics movement. And then it becomes, some of the work in that chapter comes about finding linkages, as I just read, between stealing futures and stealing land and stealing people, and how can just the word steal become a useful linguistic vehicle.
So, do you the other characters, you brought people in the book like Caesar and Royal, two men who really were very powerful figures, not knowing what they would, what would become of them during the course of the story. But, I mean, that these stories need those kind of heroic figures as well as the others that were created.
Yeah, I mean, Caesar, I want to represent different kinds of slavery. And so there's a 100-person plantation we know from pop culture. And then there's Caesar, and his story is not atypical, but he was on a small family farm in Virginia with his parents. His master taught him how to read and, said that when I die, I'll free you and your parents. Of course, when she dies, her relatives will sell Caesar and his family off with the furniture. He's another object to be sold, and he's sold south and comes down to a really harsh plantation where Cora is. So he's like – so he comes from a different kind of plantation, and then it broadens the reader's idea of how it works in different states and how Virginia is different from Georgia. Some of the men are love interests. How can Cora enter into any kind of notion of love when she's been brutalized and raped on a plantation? So what are these different kinds of freedom? And there's freedom from having a house and a job, and there's also freedom to love and to love yourself. And so, the supporting cast hopefully, provide different ways of of Cora to see how she just feels about herself and other people.
And I think that part of what this is, you know, I was thinking about somebody was talking about the night about Roots, the original Roots on TV, and the one that just produced now. And one of the things I think that's so important here is that no matter which character you're talking about in your book, whether it's Cora or Caesar or Royal or Ridgway, even the slave catcher, or the folks in the land of Indiana, Valentine and the others, that the nuance of personality, that the individual, we never look back in history on these things and think about individual people going through trauma, going through things in life that actually affect how they behave with other human beings. You know, you think that's like a 21st century fabrication, but it's not.
No,
right?
But,
you know what I'm saying?
But it's great that we have the language now. I mean, shell shock cowardice for World War I soldiers. Yeah, they're traumatized. Yeah, I mean,
right?
They don't want to go out again. I mean, their brains are, you know. And then we develop a language for trauma, and because it gets debased in, you know, in daily therapeutic talk shows.
Right.
But
Cora couldn't let herself go. She couldn't. I mean, what the trauma she faced is why she couldn't let her love out.
Yes.
Right.
And that's a realistic, whether just from an abused home or an incredibly abusive torture mill like a plantation. That's a human problem. How do we let other people in, or you know, learn to figure out ourselves? So you know, I really wanted to get a psychologically rich portrait of a slave, and then also just, I'm glad you think the characters are nuanced, but you want everyone else to be similarly complex and have their human strengths and foibles and weaknesses and. Be true to who we are. We're not perfect people.
No, none of us are. Right?
And we have ideas. Right. We have high ideas. We don't always live up to them. And sometimes we have bad ideas. And so,
what happens to Colson Whitehead to you? I mean, like an actor who has to, if an actor does his job right, they give themselves over to their character. That they have to live in a different body for what X period of time. On stage in front of a camera, whatever that is, and sometimes you can't even get out of it even when you're done with getting on stage. That's always a problem. But so for you as a writer, when you immerse yourself in this world for that period of time to finish this book, I mean, so what happened?
Well, it was terrifying before I started writing and was doing the research and realizing what a realistic plantation would be, and it's going to be disgusting and inhumane and more terrifying than, you know, we can reckon. You know, we can't. Our minds can't really wrap around the daily experience of a slave. But so realizing the terrible things I'd have to do to the characters much more than, you know, I've ever done before was very depressing. And then once I started writing, I found that distance between being in there with them and engaged and also apart as someone shaping a story. And is this paragraph going on too long? Or when am I introducing this character?
Right.
So you want to have the characters live, and also hopefully your pacing and structure and grammar and word choice, all that stuff that is, you know, engaged in construction. You know, half your brain's there over there, and the other half's over there. So I found a mix early, but then you know, towards the end, definitely, I started feeling for Cora just as a person and not even as a writer. Like,
yeah,
just like.
Right. I did as a reader.
Yeah, I
right?
mean, hopefully,
right,
but
right.
I'm not supposed to get choked up over what my characters are doing. And, you know, I can go to the last 10 pages, which I think, you know, the best 10 pages I've ever written, and feel really involved and feel for Cora as like a reader and not someone who made it.
The last 10 pages of your book you're talking about.
Yeah.
The last 10 pages, we want to talk about them. But
No.
We will not talk about them, but they were amazing.
No, thanks.
It's an amazing, amazing journey.
So that's new for me. In terms of doing with the brutality of the subject matter. I had that distance, and then about 100 pages in, I was like, oh, I can watch 12 Years a Slave. You know, it's not going to get in my head. I'm already going with the story. And I'd put off watching it, and I can only get through an hour. So I could put my characters through the experience on the page, but I couldn't actually see human actors doing it, like seeing a child being brutalized in the way that I was brutalizing my characters and seeing a human face on the experience was too much. And I still haven't gone back to it. I've only seen the first hour of it.
Yeah, it's very tough.
I mean, I'll watch Texas Chainsaw. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
People getting their heads cut off. I don't care.
Because that's separate.
Yeah.
And that is fantasy, right? Yeah. Right. But also, I think the important thing before we roll is to leave each other is the resistance, resiliency, and hope that resides in so many people in this book that came through us on her journeys, the people she met, but also came through in the world you created in Indiana, this beautiful, almost utopian black world that you envisioned that she would end, you know, that was like, again, I can't talk about what happened there because I want people to be able to read the book and get excited as they're through it, but I mean that and the tensions you build into that, but I mean that's important stuff.
That resistance and hope, you know, it'd be a better country if all of us could tap into that more often or in a more daily fashion. And we are beaten down by life, and we're not always able to put ourselves up there or be, that higher self that would make things better. But it's important. It's important when we can tap into it, and great things happen when we do. So
yeah, I mean that was what I really had a good time living in that community while I was there in your book.
It is a nice place.
It's a nice place.
Yeah,
it's very cool. Colson, I just want to say, first of all, I deeply appreciate you. I know you're so busy. This book has taken on the national imagination and people reading it everywhere now. But I deeply appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to come through here.
It was a real pleasure. My first time in Baltimore. Nice introduction.
It's good to have you here, man. So, Colson Whitehead, The Underground Railroad, is an incredible book. You do want to read this book, and good to have you here, man.
Thanks a lot.